Hello and welcome back to Naxos Classical Spotlight. The music you just heard is from a new Naxos album featuring music by Joseph Bologna, Chevalier de Saint-Georges, whose music is also much featured in the catalog of the music publisher Artaria Editions. This podcast features an interview with the New Zealand-based musicologist Dr. Alan Badley, co-founder of Artaria Editions. I began my chat with Alan by asking how Artaria Editions got started.
I had had quite a lot of experience in editing music that I wanted to hear, which I'd begun doing when I was a master's student at the University of Auckland. In fact, I conducted a performance, what would be a modern world premiere of a Leopold Hoffmann symphony back in 1982, I think it was. No, 1981, which was terribly exciting for me. And I'd always believed that hearing is believing with music, particularly when you're working on old music from the past. And there'd been sort of a few instances since this time where I'd managed to, using various sort of wiles and sort of blackmail, to persuade people to perform things that I was working on. So when I returned from Vienna in the late 1980s, we eventually moved to Wellington in 1990, where my wife had joined the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra. And shortly after this period, I found myself really reduced to doing other work that we weren't anticipating to do. And one of these things was managing the New Zealand Chamber Orchestra. And the New Zealand Chamber Orchestra had already been recording for Koch, and we were interested in beginning to record with Naxos. So when Klaus Heyman was in Wellington talking with the NZSO, we had a meeting, and he very sort of properly said, well, all right, you want to record, what can you do that other orchestras can't do? And being something of an opportunist, of course, I sort of leapt in and said, oh, well, I think we could begin recording music that has not been performed for a couple of hundred years. So he and I talked quite a bit over the next month or two and subsequent visits. And so the company was born, where the object of this really was for me and various colleagues to be able to discover suitable repertory that we could edit and publish and feed the Naxos orchestras around the world with interesting and varied repertory. So the company was formally established in 1995, so we've actually been going, you know, quite a decent period now.
Thank you.
What kinds of challenges do you face in preparing this music? You must come upon it in many different states.
Yes, that's certainly true. Over the years, I've worked with all kinds of sources. Generally, we work with manuscript sources. The large percentage of music that was written in the 18th century was not printed, particularly in places like Vienna. So Paris was an important centre for music publishing, as was London and to a certain extent Amsterdam. But Vienna, which was my stamping ground, was rather slow to join the party. So we were mainly working with manuscript sources. Now, these could be beautifully copied by professional copyists, or they could be really, really ratty copies, very untidy, full of mistakes, which does make you wonder what on earth the performances were like during this period, because you don't see many corrections on the parts. And also, there'd be parts missing from time to time. You would find, you know, pages that had been damaged or had been ripped, or the last two pages of the basso part was missing. And I was remain a fairly adept forger of missing parts for this period. So what began then was a period of kind of reconstructive surgery on the pieces. So working backwards from the extant performing material to turn them into a score where I could sort of rationalise the markings, I could reconstruct from parallel passages, I could forge little sections if there was text missing. And then once that process was finished, we could extract parts that would now hopefully be clean and error-free, or at least they'd contain my errors rather than those of an 18th century copyist. And then began the second and perhaps the most fascinating part of this process for me, which was giving music to orchestras or to soloists that had no performing tradition. And so they had to create interpretations of this music. They couldn't just go to YouTube or, although that was not in existence at this time, or they couldn't buy an LP or a CD, listen to it and say, oh, that sounds good, I think I'll copy this performance but play it slightly faster. They had to approach the music as they would a contemporary work and get right inside it and then create something new. So every performance of the thing was fresh. They really were world premiere performances and recordings. And I found that process, because I was involved, whenever things were recorded in New Zealand, I was very closely involved in this process. And that was utterly fascinating. And I learned a lot as a musicologist from the whole process of performance.
Thank you.
So why are some composers simply forgotten? There was a time when you would think that Mozart and Haydn and a couple of other people were the only composers that actually existed. And obviously you're proving this wrong. So why are some composers overlooked or forgotten?
The brutal answer, I suppose, is that history is very selective, and it generally, after a time, comes to the right conclusions about who are the towering figures. And although I'm a great champion of the composers that I work on, and I'm a sort of a wild-eyed enthusiast, I'm never going to say, Schmidt, Bauer, or Dittersdorf, or Hoffmann could have taught Mozart a thing or two, and really he's vastly overrated. So we've got the process of canonization, where in the 19th century, scholars and to a certain extent performers began to create a canon of musical works that was similar to that existed in literature, where the great figures of the past began to form a sort of codified whole. And these then began to form the basis of concert programs. Of course, in the 19th century, there were new composers coming along who have subsequently been forgotten, of course, but also, towering figures like Brahms and Mendelssohn and Schumann, who, while they weren't of the sort of historic importance at this time as Bach or Handel, nonetheless impressed fairly early on that they were major figures. As music shifted, as styles changed, gradually more and more of the composers fell off the leaderboard. So you were left finally with, in Vienna, you were really left with the big three of Haydn, Mozart and Beethoven. And because much of the music wasn't published and wasn't accessible in easily usable editions, it simply wasn't played. But one thing that is interesting is when you look at extant copies of this music, and I've actually been looking at some Hoffmann sacred music this morning, you realise, although this music was written in the 1760s and 1770s, it was still being performed in the 1850s and 1860s. It did have a very, very long life, even if it's not recognised today. And so with musicology gaining traction in the 20th century and a lot of work initially going into investigating the musical context in which our great figures operated, we began to get figures who began to take an interest in some of these so-called secondary figures. And so Paul Bryan, working on Van Hal and other scholars like him, began this process of rediscovery and championing them. But, of course, it takes a long time for them to become known. And it often shocks people to learn that the Haydn symphonies weren't actually published in their entirety till the 1960s, which really isn't very long ago. Well, it is to my students, but to chaps of my age, the 1960s seems almost like yesterday. And it's improbable to think that a composer like that should still have had so much music unpublished. I mean, one of the things that distinguishes the towering genius from other composers, no matter how good they are, is there are just so few lemons, really. You can look through the whole of Beethoven's output and you can occasionally point a quivering finger of outrage at something like Wellington's Victory. But apart from that, he really didn't lower the standard at all. The works have a kind of uniform polish and brilliance about them. But most of them are capable of writing some very, very fine works. And the works that aren't as good or aren't as obviously brilliant are still nonetheless extremely interesting. These were very, very accomplished figures. It's interesting to consider, were they alive and working in a similar environment today, all of these figures? I mean, how would we evaluate them? We would assume that Mozart and Beethoven were still at the top of the tree, but would many of our contemporary composers who are well-regarded at the moment actually compare as well with a figure like Van Hal or Dittersdorf or Johann Stamitz? So they were no slugs. They were extremely clever at what they did. And they also do things sometimes in a different way. If history is always written by the victors, I think great art tends to define how we view these periods. And you'll find that sometimes the most astonishingly original work isn't produced by a composer like Mozart. He is just capable of somehow taking what is a convention and just transforming it into something unutterably beautiful, a sort of magical alchemical process of genius. And yet in terms of something startlingly original, you'll find that a composer like Dittersdorf is a far more formidable figure in terms of original thinking.
So who was Joseph Bologna Chevalier de Saint-Georges?
Well, he is, by a fairly distant measure, is, I think, the most spectacularly talented, universally talented individual of the 18th century. There are a lot of extraordinary figures during this period, but I think Saint-Georges, both in terms of his background and the range of his talents, is really something else. I mean, Mozart might have been a fabulous forte pianist, a peerless improviser and a magnificent composer. But I mean, how would he have been in a fencing match if he'd ever had to fight a duel with someone? You know, he probably would have been dead meat within seconds. So with Saint-Georges, we have someone who was a violinist of great virtuosity, obviously a very, very fine player, and a very accomplished composer. I would hesitate to say a great composer, because I think that it's dishonest to talk people up. But even to say that he is comparable to virtually all of his contemporaries is to lavish a great deal of praise on him as a composer. He was also regarded as one of the finest, if not the finest, swordsmen in Europe. He was an all-round athlete who attracted crowds wherever he went. Apparently, there's a report that he used to swim across the Seine in Paris with one hand tied behind his back, and he could shoot a button out of the air at sort of 25 paces with a dueling pistol. So he has all these all-round attributes of athlete, of great intellect, of personal charm, obviously a fine musician, an excellent orchestra leader, and a very good composer. So this range of skills makes him really very, very unique, if one can have very unique. I suppose one is or one isn't. But Saint-Georges really does stand alone in this respect.
He would have knocked it dead on social media, my heavens.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly he attracted a great deal of attention from many attractive and presumably wealthy young Parisians during the 1770s and 1780s. He was obviously of very striking physical appearance, not just because he was of mixed race, but simply he seems to have been a very handsome man. And being very athletic, was beautifully built and graceful with everything that goes with that kind of physical accomplishment. It must have come as quite a surprise to people who knew of Saint-Georges the horseman, they knew of Saint-Georges the swordsman, and then all of a sudden are confronted with, God, the man plays the violin, and he's an extraordinary violinist, and he's giving a premiere of his violin concertos. And interestingly, I think that some of the writing in the violin concertos, particularly the rapid passage work and high position work, I think has a physical quality to it. And I think that Saint-Georges, in a sense, wrote works that he was going to play that also exploited a certain sort of athleticism and grace as a performer. So when he's playing, you know, right up in the very, very highest register, you know, with the hand bent over, just about tickling his chin, you can imagine he would have seemed like this extraordinarily graceful balletic figure executing music of great sort of difficulty and complexity. And I think aware of the physical appearance, presumably he dressed beautifully. The one portrait we have of him, it shows that he was a man who dressed very fashionably. So if we imagine the physical appearance on the stage and the dazzling virtuosity of the playing and the attractiveness of the music, I think he was consciously trying to exploit all of these elements in his musical work.
So tell us a bit about this new recording about to come out of his Symphonie Concertante and his Symphony in G Major. What do we have to look forward to here?
Saint-Georges I wouldn't have said as an original composer. He's not a trailblazer, but he was certainly an earlier adopter of new musical styles. And so in Paris in the early 1770s, there had been very, very, very few string quartets written by French composers. And yet the young Saint-Georges publishes, as his opus 1, a set of string quartets. He then adopts this newfangled genre, the symphonie concertante. So again, he's a very, very early adopter of this form. And he'd written two works which were published as opus 6, and then the works on the new recording, opus 9 and opus 10, these date from the second half of the 1770s, and they certainly predate Mozart's works in the genre. They were written in all instances featuring two violin parts, although some of the symphonies concertante also have a solo viola part. So we see the way in which Saint-Georges alternates a kind of symphonic aesthetic in the orchestral sections, and yet in the solo sections, these are really reduced to a kind of chamber music of great delicacy with say, the two violin soloists weaving in and out of each other, sometimes playing in thirds and sixths. Not quite the dazzling virtuosity that we hear in the violin concertos, but clearly written for excellent performers, and one presumes that he played the first solo part, and perhaps the leader of the second violins in the orchestra played the second solo part, and the principal viola, if we had positions like this in the 18th century, would play the viola part. So the works are new, and they're also fashionable. Most of them are in two movements. We think of concertos and symphonies being in three or four movements, but these are two movement works which characteristically end with a rondo finale. And the rondo was also a newfangled form. I mean, Bach had written them, of course, and other composers, but they became very, very fashionable, particularly in France in the early 1770s. So Saint-Georges cultivates this new form. He cultivates the new rondo finale with catchy tunes in the rondo and a bit of dazzling virtuosity and sometimes some very, very lovely haunting melodies in the minor key episodes in the rondo, and produces music which has been described as kind of music of urbane sophistication, not intellectually powerful like a Haydn symphony, not complex in the way a Mozart concerto is. But these works unfold in a rather leisurely fashion. They're very, very lyrical. They're entertaining in the sense that the soloists, and these soloists weren't itinerant virtuosi as we know today, but would have been very, very well-known figures in the Parisian musical world, members of the orchestra and so forth. And so they would entertain with these beautiful works. In many respects, they are more interesting than his violin concertos, simply because they represent early forms of the work. Thank you.
important question is, if somebody is listening to this music on this new recording, how do they get the music so they can play it themselves?
If you buy a physical copy of the CD, there is always a panel in the back of the CD book, which tells you that the works, at least in the series that I work on, have been published by Arteria Editions. And there's a website there, and it tells you the sources upon which the editions have been made. If listeners go to the Arteria website, www.arteria.com, of course, we have hundreds and hundreds of works for sale, both in scores and with parts. And in fact, Saint George has, as you are probably aware, because of all sorts of political movements in the last year or so, has suddenly enjoyed a great renaissance. And so I've spent a good deal of time over the last year editing new works by St. George. So Arteria is in the process at the moment of publishing the Violin Concertos Opus 2, Opus 7, the Symphonies Concertantes Opus 6 and Opus 13, and two sets of string quartets. So there should be almost a comparative avalanche of new St. George works coming out on Naxos Recordings. And all of these will be available through Arteria Editions.
Been listening to an interview with Dr. Alan Baddeley about composer Joseph Bologna, Chevalier de Saint-Georges, and about Arteria, or as it's sometimes pronounced, Arteria Editions, the publishing house he co-founded along with Naxos founder Klaus Hamann. You can find their website at www.arteria.com. The music in this podcast comes from a new recording of the Symphonie Concertante by Saint-Georges with the Czech Chamber Philharmonic Orchestra Pardubice, conducted by Mikhail Halas, along with soloist Yuri Revich, Libor Ješek, and Pavla Honsova, all on a new Naxos album catalog number 8.574306. That's all for this podcast. Dr. Baddeley will join me again over the coming months to introduce some of the other composers in the Arteria catalog, their music, and their often wildly colorful lives. Until then, I'm Raymond Bechet. Thanks for joining me. So long for now.